Hello, and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I am Harry Brady, and this is podcast number 228. Was a season like no other, marking an end of an era and transition to a different world in more ways than one. Jock Steen had managed Celtic for the last time and his European Cup winning captain was to take over the reins. The Rangers team, which had been successful in the post nine in a row years of Celtic, were ageing, and two new clubs in the northeast were starting to show how they would come briefly to challenge the perceived order of Scottish football off the field. 1978-79 started with a song from the film of the summer at number one, You're the One That I Want from Greece, which was there for 9 weeks, with three times the leader replacing it. And in politics, we saw two more transitions. The Labour government had lost its majority in Parliament, and despite being ahead in the polls, cuddly Jim Callaghan saw no need to call an election. Over the course of the 78-79 season, we would see the lead of the old order be lost, the winter of discontent and the season ending with a woman as Prime Minister. Changing days indeed. In the middle of all that, Celtic came from mid-table oblivion to a final game showdown to face Rangers for the title. Only a victory would do for the Celts, and in 58 minutes things looked bleak and Johnny Doyle was sent off with Celtic at 1-0 down. But the players rallied around and 10 men won the league. Stephen Murray of This Parish has written a book about the almost mythical season, and this podcast finds out more. Listen to the end to find out how you could win a signed copy of the book. And if you don't win one, go on to Amazon and buy one. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Stephen Murray. I love you. I am joined now by St. Anthony, but because of the topic of this, I'm going to give him his proper name. I'm joined by author Stephen Murray. So, Saint stroke Stephen Murray, how you doing?
I'm fine, Harry, thanks.
So, I say author because you are the proud writer of a brand new Celtic book. So I will let you do all the honours of tell us the name of the book and tell us why you decided a book needed to be written about this topic. So on you go.
Well, the name of the book is 10 Men Won the League, and the reason for writing it was it really relates to one of the most memorable games in Celtic's history, where in the last game of the 1978-79 season, they faced Rangers in the last league game, and they beat them 4-2, but more than that, they were 1-0 down and down to 10 men when they came back to win 4-2. It was the most remarkable night and the most remarkable football game that I've ever witnessed. And really, what I wanted to do was to put that story out there, not only in terms of the game itself, but to tell the story of the season, because it was an astounding season in many ways, but purely and simply because the tightness of the league title. I mean, there was Celtic, Rangers and Dundee United right into the last couple of games, and there was also a really bad winter that year, which led to Celtic not playing a league game for 10 weeks. So that was basically 10 league games that they had to catch up with. And towards the end of the season, they were playing two, sometimes three games a week. And they went on a wonderful run, and we ended up winning the league on that tremendous night against Rangers.
So what really prompted you to say that you, Stephen Murray, should become an author?
it was something that I had in mind, and at first I thought I would maybe write something for Celtic Underground and put it on, and then I thought, well, it would be too long and real day for maybe an internet story, an internet article. So after that point, I thought, well, I could maybe write a wee book here, and it was actually my wife who encouraged me to do it for my own pleasure. And at first I was just going to write about the game, but in order to get the whole feel of how important that game was, I then expanded it a wee bit to tell the story of the whole season, because many, many interesting things were happening. And in order to appreciate how that game came to being as important as it was, you really have to read a wee bit about the season itself. So it did expand slightly, but I think it makes more sense, because if I just wrote about the game, it would have been interesting, but I think you have to tell the full story in its entirety in order to appreciate just how much an important season this was.
So what are the specific challenges, before I get on to the content of the book, what are the specific challenges of becoming a first-time author? You know, basics, how do you decide, do you start the book on what ends up being page one and finish it on page, whatever the last page number is? How do you get it published? All of these things. Take us through, if somebody's listening to this and thinking, do you know, there's a story about Celtic or a story of anything in my life that I would like to write a book about. Mm-hmm. How would they start it, and what would some of the advice that you do, and what might you do differently compared to how you started?
Really, how I started was I wanted to tell the story in a diary fashion so that it would be easy for the reader to read. And I also wanted it to be the kind of book that you could pick up at any page and it would make sense. So, for example, if you opened up at a random page, you'll find the story of the game and which page you open up. So it means that you don't have to read the whole thing just to... you know, each game has a wee story to itself. And obviously, the games are in chronological order, building up to the last game where Celtic beat Rangers 4-2. So I wanted it to be an easy book to read. And what I've tried to do as well is try and enhance the book a wee bit, because it's not all about Celtic. It's all about what was happening at Scottish football at that time. Off the top of my head, Ali McLeod, for example, was in the back of coming back from the World Cup in Argentina when the book starts. So Scottish football was nearly in a great place. Although these days we would accept qualifying for a World Cup finals, even if we performed dismally, it would be seen as progress. But in those days, we had a tremendous calibre of player in Scotland, and we should really have done better than what we did. And the other thing that the book begins with as well, Jock Stein moved on and Billy McNeil became the manager. Now, Billy McNeil was only Celtic's fifth manager in 90 years, which is an astounding statistic. And I made the point at the book launch that you know, when you count up how many managers we've had since then, honestly, you would lose count. And this was big news in 1978, Celtic having a new manager. And the irony was that within a matter of days, Jock Wallace resigned at Rangers, and Rangers had a new manager. So there was a lot of things happening at the time, and it was quite an exciting period, especially when you're young and I have a great recollection of that period. So in terms of writing the book, it was fairly simple to have it in a diary fashion in chronological order. But I think what makes the book, in my eyes, a wee bit special is that there's some fantastic recollections from Celtic players of the period. And that includes guys like Danny McGrain, Davy Proven, Nick Conroy, Peter Latchford, Bobby Lennox, Sandy Lynch, players who were big players for Celtic at that time. And they gave me an insight to what was happening at the club at the time. And again, I don't want to beat my own drum, but the some of the stuff they give me, I think, is terrific. And I think it reads very well. And I think any Celtic fan who remembers that period will look back with a lot of affection in some of the things that the guys are saying.
So what are the challenges of getting a book published?
Well, it's fairly simple these days in respect of Amazon do self-publishing. And really what happens there is you have your document that you've on your computer, and you download it to Amazon. and they put it on, and then people can buy your book just the same way as any of the big authors that you would buy on Amazon. So my book is now on Amazon to buy, and anyone who wants to buy it can just go on and buy it the same way you would any other book. So it's a tremendous opportunity for people like me who... I never bothered chasing a publisher because I wanted to be in control of my own destiny. I wanted the book to turn out the way that I wanted, and I wanted to make all the decisions. And I'm not sure if you get a publisher, then that's the case. And really, it's a very small project on my own behalf. It's not a big grand effort, although the book is fairly substantial. I think it's roughly speaking, it's 300 pages.
Yeah.
So, if beating my own drum, if I say so myself, it is a good read. You know, it is a substantial book. It did take 2 years of research to go into it in order to get where we are now. And I have to say that I'm fairly pleased with the end product.
Well, let's go on to the book itself, because it's actually, regardless of the 4-2, in many ways that season is an interesting time in Scottish football, as you've already identified. The 70s start off with Celtic domination through the 9 in a row. Mm-hmm. And then the 80s commence with the creation and the formation of the new firm, and obviously the dominant and their success with Alex Ferguson at Aberdeen, Jim McLean at Dundee United. And as you've just identified, the sort of seeds to that change in Scottish football, you can start to see, although it's Celtic that win the league, you can start to see it in this season. Rangers had been successful with the trebles and Jock Wallace was there, and Celtic got Billy McNeil. So tell us about the start of that season.
Well, really, the hardest part for me writing this whole book was to the hardest chapter to write was the introduction at the very beginning, because you have to paint a picture for the reader, especially the younger guys who don't recall the period of the time. So what I was trying to do was Celtic, in Jock's team last season, Celtic had a really bad season. We finished fifth in the league, we didn't qualify for Europe. We get put out the Scottish Cup to Kilmarnock, who were a division below us at that time. We get put out by a fairly mediocre opposition in the European Cup. And there was some really, really bad results that season. For example, Clyde Bank beat us at Kilbowie, they were in the 10-team Premier League at that time.
Yep.
And St Mirren were also a newly promoted team under Alex Ferguson, and they beat us in three of the four league games. So when you put all that together, it was a fairly miserable season. And this was a tremendous shock, because I was 12, 13 years old at the time. And for guys of my generation, Jock Stein was a god. And all of a sudden, he felt the earth with a thump. And the team, as I said, performed pretty bad. Although, in fairness, there was mitigating circumstances for that. They saw Kenny Dalglish at the start of the season, and it's a wee bit like Henrik Larsson. You just know sometimes when a player goes that you're not going to be able to replace them. It's going to take some time. And I think we all appreciated that with Kenny. And then Danny McGrain got a bad injury, kept him out for most of the season. Pat Stanton had an injury so bad that he had to retire. And Alfie Conn, who was a big player for Celtic at that point, had a bad injury as well. So really, about half the team, probably the four best players we had at that point, disappeared for most of the season. And some of the young boys that came in tried manfully, and Jock also signed a sort of jumble of mediocrity, to be honest. Guys from that era always talk about Roy Kay and Frank Munro and Ian McWilliams. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that they were bad players, they just joined at a really bad time. And it wasn't very easy. And when you're replacing guys like Kenny Dalglish and Danny McGrain, frankly, you know, it's going to be a hard shift for anyone. So at the beginning of the book, it paints a fairly miserable tone for Celtic. Although the optimism rises when Billy McNeil takes over. And then he begins to through the first few months of the season, he begins to stamp his authority on the team. He signs Davy Proven, which was a tremendous signing. And then Murdo McLeod comes in, and they brought Bobby Lennox back to America. And he also brought in guys like Mike Conroy. And Alan Steadon and people like that from who were coming for the juniors. So, and some of the older players were also on their way out. Guys who'd been good players, actually. Guys like Ronnie Glavin and Joe Craig and Paul Wilson. Mm-hmm. And then Pat Stanton retired. So there's a lot of change in personnel. And this is very much a new year. And really what happens towards the end of the season is Celtic is a very, very young team. And they were playing a lot of games towards the end, and some of the players admitted that it was really their youthful energy was getting them through it. And they were a fairly fit team in those days. And as I said, they were playing two, sometimes three games a week. And they just hit form at the right time.
I think you've got, you know, you're talking about the difficult start. I think one of the pictures you've got in your book is that very famous picture of when Billy McNeil gets the job.
Mm-hmm.
And Jock's, and there's the handshake with Jock Stein standing behind it, looking very disgruntled. Did the players that you spoke to make any comment about their thoughts on the changeover from Stein to McNeil, or is there too much loyalty to both men to say anything?
Really, it was guys like Andy Lynch and Peter Latchford, who were experienced players at the time, said that when Jock left, he never said any goodbyes, because the season had finished and the players had actually went on holiday when it was announced that Jock had moved on and Billy was coming in. And they said that there were rumours, I mean, the city was awash with rumours for a long time, that Jock was going to move on and Billy would come in. But the players some of the players were quite sad that they didn't get to say, some farewells to Jock, because they thought a lot of him. And the first time they met Billy, it was the first day of pre-season training. And really what Billy said was he knew that they had a bad season and that he wanted to hit the ground running. And he just asked for their support, and he said in return for their support, he would give them every encouragement. And there's one fairly humorous part where Mike Conroy told me that, and Danny McGrain actually admits this, that Billy was giving his first ever team talk, and he was very serious, and all the players were standing around about him. And he said, "Now, I know some of you personally, and I've socialised with some of you, I've played with you." He said, "But you know, that social thing's got to stop now. I'm no longer Billy. I want to be referred to as boss or gaffer." Okay, so there's no more being informal. We have to be professional here. There's no more. You can't call me Billy anymore. And then he goes into this team talk about what he expects of them all. And then he comes into Danny McGrain, who was the captain at the time, and he says, "Danny, you're the captain. Is there anything you would like to add to that?" Danny McGrain comes in and replies, no, Billy, no really. and the whole place just burst out laughing, and Billy McNeil actually walked away because he was trying not to laugh, because Danny was being cheeky or speaking out of order. It was just typical Danny McGrain, apparently. He was dead laid back and, you know, he's just that kind of guy.
So the new manager comes in, there's a changeover of players. Things didn't really take off straight away, did they?
They made a good start. They won seven of their first eight league games, which was a terrific run. And the most vital one at that time was a 3-1 win against Rangers in September, which laid in a wee marker that Rangers had won the treble the previous year and had a very good team at the time. I mean, off the top of my head, the Rangers forward line at the time was McLean, Russell, Johnson, Smith and Cooper, which remains the best Rangers forward line that I've ever seen. That includes your Loudups and your Gascoigne's in later years. And this team was a good Rangers team. And what that old firm win in September meant was that it proved that Rangers were the unbeatable and that Celtic on their game could still compete with the best. But as you said there, that when it came to October, November, December, then through a horrendous period where they only won 1 in 11 league games. And you just can't imagine any manager, whether it's Celtic or any other team, especially Celtic, to be honest, who could survive a period of winning only one league game in 11. It's an astounding statistic. And yet the fans were remarkably patient. There wasn't any demonstrations, there wasn't any protests or anything like that. the fans were still behind the team and encouraging the players in every respect. And it was a special period for the Celtic support, because I know the old song Celtic supporters were faithful through and through. It was tougher to be faithful then, because there was more competition certainly in the in Scotland, and Aberdeen and Dundee United, as you said, were coming to the fore, and St Mirren had a superb team at the time, and then there was other teams like Partick Thistle and Morton who had really good outfits. So really, the season changed for Celtic at Christmas, because they just lost to Morton on the 23rd of December, and I think they were lying with something like sixth in the league. And then the snow came, and it was a horrible, horrible winter. It was really, there was snow and ice on a scale that we hadn't seen for a generation. And the game was decimated in Scotland, so much so that the league had to convene to extend the season. The season was originally meant to finish in April 28th, and it actually ran on to May the 31st, so that's over a month. This gives you an idea of the number of games that the teams had to catch up on. But Celtic were the worst affected, because there was 10 consecutive weeks where they didn't play games on a Saturday because of the conditions. And even when the thaw came, when the snow melted, the parks flooded and got waterlogged. So it was a horrible, horrible winter in terms of the weather, but it was a blessing in disguise, because it was, some of the players describe it as having another pre-season. Billy McNeil was able to get the player out in the training pitch wherever he could find a decent standard, and he worked the players into getting fitter, and also to get them bonding together, to get a feeling of togetherness. And every guy that I spoke to speaks very fondly of a trip in January to Portugal. Mm-hmm. To Estoril, which everyone out there, I think, who's a Celtic fan will have heard of Estoril, because that's where we stayed in Lisbon in 67, in the resort of Estoril. And the players that I spoke to said that they went out there, a group of individuals, but they came back as a team, because it was a terrific trip. It was good weather. They played a game, certainly, they got a lot of training done. But more importantly than that, Billy let the hair down a wee bit, and they were able to socialise, and they came together, and so much so that they became quite a tight group after that.
I suppose it's for younger listeners, to make myself sound like an old man, it is important to mention, when you're talking about Celtic going on a game where they win 1 out of 11, it was only 2 points for a win.
Yeah.
So although that was a disastrous run, you could still have a run like that and not be completely cut adrift from being able to win the title.
The other point I should make is that you're right there about the 2 points for a win, but the other point I really should make is that everyone in that league beat each other at some point. It was a crazy season. The two teams that got relegated that season were Motherwell and Hearts, and they both beat Celtic, but they also both beat Rangers. So it gives you an indication of how competitive that league was. And I'm sure, I'm working to memory here, there was a period right up until January, there was only 12 points in a 10-team Premier League between top place and bottom place. And that's quite astounding, because nobody at that point had sunk to the bottom, although Motherwell did in the late winter of 1979. They ended up being quite isolated. But it was a very, very tight league, and it's no exaggeration to say that anybody could beat anybody on their day. And that made it very, very competitive that season.
And then the other thing which we'd mentioned when we spoke last time was the number of goals scored by Celtic's top goal scorer that season.
Oh, aye.
it's incredible. It was Tom McAdam with, what was it, 7 goals, 8 goals?
Tom McAdam and Andy Lynch were joint league top scorers with 7 goals.
And Andy Lynch took the penalty, so that's the reason why he had the goals.
Yeah, you're right about Andy, obviously, that he had the penalties to show, but Tom McAdam was the top scorer. He was the top scorer in all competitions with 15 goals, which is still a fairly lame effort for a Celtic team. But when you look at the league games, 36 league games were played that season, and the best we could do was the best someone could do was score 7 goals. But it should be pointed out as well that the goals were very much spread about. I mean, guys like Murdo McLeod and Davy Proven, Alfie Conn, Ronnie Glavin, Andy Lynch himself, they all chipped in a good number of goals. So the goals were coming from all over the pitch. We weren't relying on one player or even two players to get those goals.
So you spoke to players about that season, and they've all very helped to contribute to making the book what it is. So what players was it you spoke with?
The two guys who were the greatest assistants were Mike Conroy and Davy Proven. And the reason for that is that they have vivid recollections of the time. Some of the other players remembered certain things but couldn't remember others. But Davy and Mike could remember most things in graphic. In fact, they can remember everything in graphic detail. Probably because they were a wee bit younger at that time. They were only 20, 21 years old. And Mike Conroy, in particular, can remember every Celtic game they ever played in. He can tell you the dates and everything. And when you're writing a book and you're looking for detail, that was a godsend. And he's such a nice guy. Mike Conroy is an absolute gem. I can't describe how terrific it was to speak to him. He's Celtic through and through, and he's just a nice, nice guy. And I'm a wee bit apprehensive about meeting Davy Proven because he's got quite a media personality, a media profile at the moment. And I wasn't sure how he would react, and he could not have been more helpful either. So much so that he volunteered to do the foreword for the book, which I greatly appreciate. And I know there's people out there that maybe take exception to Davy's comments in the papers or TV or whatever, but Davy Proven is a huge, huge Celtic man. I was delighted to do the podcast for the site when I was interviewing him for the book. Mm-hmm. That was a wee added bonus. And those two guys were the best. But there was other people as well. Andy Lynch was terrific. He called me from Spain, which was very good of him because he's over in Spain just now. And then there was Peter Latchford, Danny McGrain, and Joe Felipe, and Bobby Lennox, who were all... people might not think Joe Felipe... In the great scheme of things compared to Danny McGrain and Bobby Lennox. But Joe played 20 games that season in the league, and he again had a recollection of what was happening. In fact, he lost his place only because Danny McGrain came back from injury.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really, in his own words, keeping Danny's jersey wanting to come back. But I also have to say as well, and this is a strange one that people laugh at, somebody gave me Gordon Smith's phone number.
Yep.
And I called them up to say I was writing a book about the 4-2 game of that season, and I really wanted to be fair in writing it and get a Rangers perspective, because not many people will know that Rangers were going for the second consecutive treble that season before they lost at Celtic Park and we won the league. And as I said, it was a very good Rangers team, and Gordon Smith laughed and he made a joke about he'd been trying to forget about that game for 35 years, and I wanted him to talk about it. But he gave me a couple of hours of his time, and I have to say that what a nice guy and a really great company. And I thank the world of him for doing that, because I wouldn't have been offended if he'd have told me to take a run and jump, to be frank, because of the subject matter. But Gordon Smith was a true sport and a total gentleman.
So we went through that season and we'd had that run of 11 games. We went away with the winter, postponing a lot of games and perhaps helping the Celtic players to evolve from, as you say, from individuals into a team.
Mm-hmm.
So how did we start to claw back? Was it because Celtic were so good, to paraphrase Jim White, why are you so good? Or was it that the other teams were starting to chuck it and lose?
It's probably fair comment to say that Dundee United blew it that season, because with 3 games left in their season, the ball was in their court, and they lost to Rangers at Tannadice, they lost to Celtic at Celtic Park, and they drew with Aberdeen in their last game. So in their last three games, they only picked out 1 point out of six, and they basically blew. I reckon if they'd have got four out of six, then they would have won the league that year. And they were top from maybe March onwards, and they did a fine team at the time, as everybody remembers, with the likes of Sturrock and Nairy and Hegarty. So after they had blown it, Celtic and Rangers had games in hand to catch up on, and it became a two-horse race. But for me, the turning point, the first time that I thought we could win the league, even as a boy, was a day in April. It was probably the first decent weather we'd had after all the horrible winter stuff. And we went to Love Street, and George McCluskey scored an absolute peach for 30 yards. Celtic won 1-0. And in those days, I mean, you forget how big a stadium the old Love Street was. I mean, there'd been a crowd of about 20,000 there that day, and the vast majority of them had been Celtic fans. And I remember going out the big terrace and behind the goal at the Caledonia Road, Caledonia Street. End at Paisley. And a wee roar began to go up, and a big roar, and everybody was a wee bit, you know, what's going on here? And there was a guy in front of it, and he says, Motherwell have beat Rangers 2-0 at Fir Park. And there's always that wee worry that it's a mad rumour. It became such a big noise that you know, everybody thought, God, there must be something in this. And sure, when we get back to the buses and cars, we discovered that Motherwell, who were bottom of the league, had beat Rangers 2-0. And that was the first time that I felt that somehow fate was conspiring to tell Celtic a chance. But I think we deserved it in the end up, because there was 18 games left and Danny McGrain came back. And Celtic won 14 of those. And that was the launch pad that got us the title. And I made the point at the book launch, if you remember what I said to Danny, that's no coincidence. In fact, when I interviewed Danny and I made the point to him about up until he came back, we'd only won one game in 11. And after he came back, we won 14 out of 18. Now, those statistics don't lie. Danny was not only a great player, but he was a real presence on the pitch. And Danny McGrain's reply was, that's just coincidence. The boys would have won it anyway. Which just isn't the case.
No, it's not. And I said to him at your book launch, he was talking to some kids, and I said to the kids, you do know you're speaking to the world's greatest ever right back. Because he was a fabulous player, and he plays a strong role in my favourite ever Celtic goal, away from your book for a moment, against St Mirren in the 5-0 game in 86. That's my favourite Celtic goal. But back onto the book. So the crux of the book is obviously in the starting point of what you got you talking about, the writing about the season, is the pivotal game against Rangers. So it's our last game, but it's not Rangers' last game, and we have to win.
No, as you say there, you're right. It was our last game, and if we win the league, then we win it outright. If Rangers get a draw, then they have two games playing remaining against Hibs at Easter Road and Thistle at Ibrox, and they would have needed 2 points to win the league. And if they'd won on the night against us, they would only needed 1 point to win the league in their last two remaining games. So I don't think anybody's in any doubt that if Rangers had got a draw or a win, there's no doubt that the momentum would have carried them on to win the title. So Celtic knew that only a win was acceptable. And it's hard to describe. It was almost like a cup final. I know it's a league game, but it did feel like a cup final. Although I'm trying to remember who it was. No, I think it was Davy Proven that made the point to me that before a big game, a European game or a cup tie, certainly a cup final, Billy McNeil would have took the players down to Seamill to get them away for their families, to relax and to get away for the newspaper guys and to find a bit of peace and quiet. But on this occasion, Billy said it was only a league game, it wasn't a cup final. And he let them spend the night with their families, and Davy Proven says that he thought that was quite an inspired thing, because there was a lot of inexperience in that Celtic team. I mean, these guys like George McCluskey, Tommy Burns, Roy Aitken, Murdo, Davy Proven, Mike Conroy, who were between the ages of 19 and 21. Mm-hmm. And they were the mainstay of the team at that point. These guys had became the centre point of the Celtic team. and what Derry Province here is, that by spending the night with the families, it played down the importance of what was clearly a big game, but you know, they just treated it as a normal game, and he thinks that went some way to relaxing the players before the big game.
So the game itself, not on TV, so you can't see it, although there is grainy home video footage. At Celtic Park.
Well, there was a story of that as well, because the cameramen apparently did show up on the night, and the strike, people are under the misapprehension that the cameramen went and strike. What actually happened was that the programme directors had a wildcat strike within STV. It was going to be shown in STV at 10:35 that night. And unknown to me, and this was news to me, you can't have an outside broadcast without a programme director. Therefore, the cameramen who were there just went home about 5:30 because they knew that there was no point in them staying around because they weren't going to be able to film without having a director there. So at that point, the Celtic Film Club was a big thing at the time. They used to go about the schools and churches and youth clubs and things. And they had this old video recorder, an old black and white one, and they videoed the entire game as best they could. And if you go on YouTube, you can see that the old grainy film from black and white of the goals. And it's good that they did it because it does give you an idea of how you know, what went on that night. But it's actually quite funny to watch because after some of the Celtic goals, the camera goes up and down because obviously the guys were celebrating.
Yes.
And they're not appreciating that, you know, they're, you're supposed to stay still to capture it for posterity. So, you know, you see the roof of the jungle sort of thing before it comes back down to the pitch side. But the game itself, Celtic started well, but the Rangers scored against the run of play. And it was Mike Conroy who taught me that he's still raging because he was marked by Alec McDonald, and he lost Alec McDonald for a split second. And in that split second, McDonald had the ball in the net. And Conroy says that was a hard learning curve because, you know, your concentration had to be 100%, and even if it was 99%, sometimes that wasn't good enough.
Yep.
So for the rest of the half, it was Celtic hit the bar and had the best of the play, although Danny McGrain cleared a shot off the line, which kept Celtic in it. And then at half-time, the guys I spoke to said that Billy was very calm, and he promised them if they kept playing the way they were playing, the goals would come and they would get the reward. But that the whole balance of the game changed around about the 56-57 minute mark when Alec McDonald got injured and he was lying on the ground, and John Doyle went over, and now John Doyle and Alec McDonald were like on the field anyway, they were mortal enemies. John Doyle was to Celtic but Alec McDonald was to Rangers. They were boyhood fans, they were steeped in their club, and they were real competitors and they were fiery wee characters as well. And Doyle went to pull McDonald up and McDonald pulled his hand away. And this angered Johnny, and Johnny actually kicked him twice in the ribs as McDonald was lying there. And then, as that happened, the referee, believe it or not, didn't notice this, but the jungle side linesman did. And Johnny got sent off, and some of the players actually felt that night that Johnny didn't deserve to be sent off, but there's no doubt that he did.
And
he admitted after the game that he was out of order. So Johnny Doyle runs up the tunnel and Celtic are down to 10 men and they're a goal down. And Celtic get an equaliser shortly after when Roy Aitken scored. And then Billy McNeil made what turned out to be a masterstroke. He took off Mike Conroy, who was essentially a defensive midfield player, and he threw on Bobby Lennox because obviously Celtic had to win and Billy was going for broke.
Yep.
And then John Gregg made a fatal mistake at that point. He took off Tommy McLean, who was a very creative player, and he put on Alec Miller, who, without being condescending, was a fairly average sort of defender. And it meant that Rangers got sucked into defending in their own penalty area, and they couldn't get out. Even with 10 men, Celtic were pressed them back. So Celtic went 2-1 up, and the place was, you can imagine, the place was going mad, because at this point, if it stays like this, we've won the league. And then, with about 10 minutes to go, Rangers get a corner. And it was a corner at the Rangers' end. And a Celtic player cleared the corner to the edge of the area, and it didn't seem as if there was any great danger. But Bobby Russell hit a low shot, and it must have been six Celtic players between him and the goal, and that ball managed to get past the six of them and hit the post and went in. And it was, it's hard to describe the gut-wrenching disappointment, not only for the fans who were gutted, but for the players. And then something happened that was quite remarkable in the book. As the Rangers fans are cheering, the Celtic fans were stunned momentarily. And then within a few seconds, there was a chant, Celtic, Celtic, Celtic. And it went around the whole ground for the stand, right in the Celtic end, right in the jungle, and it was deafening. And the players that I spoke to, and I'm quite proud of this, said that that was one of the things that gave them heart, was the fact that the fans were still with them. And it gave them greater energy and more encouragement to just go for broke. And Celtic just kept attacking. And they came close a couple of times before they actually got the third goal. And the reason the third goal came was Rangers were defending so deep, as I said there, that George McCluskey hit a shot across the face of goal which struck Colin Jackson. And he diverted the ball inadvertently away from Peter McCloy. And there was a big scramble on the goal line as McCloy and Jackson went to redeem the ball, and a few Celtic players were trying to get a touch to get it in. But the ball crossed the line and Celtic were 3-2 up. So that, to be honest, anybody who remembers that night, the greatest recollection people will have is Murdo McLeod's fourth goal. Because the game's in injury time, the Celtic fans are playing like hell for the final whistle. Rangers are attacking desperately, and the next thing, Celtic broke up the park, two or three Celtic players running on the left-hand side. And Davy Provan said that he had the ball, and he heard Murdo shouting, and he thought, I'll lay the ball off to Murdo, and he can take it into the corner flag. And by the time that you know, whatever happens, surely that'll be time up.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you couldn't believe it, Murdo McLeod went to try a shot. And he fired a shot right into the top corner to make it 4-2. Now, that was just the icing on the cake. But the most interesting fact that I found about describing Murdo's goal is the fact that more than one of the Celtic players were annoyed that he tried a shot. Because I think it was Danny. Danny says that he was one of the few guys still in the Celtic half. And he says, if Peter McCloy had saved that and launched it up the park, he says, I reckon it had been 5-2 in Rangers' favour, and he might have got a goal. He says, it was quite a rightless thing for Murdo to do, and yet it came off for him, and he's remembered as a hero. But some of the players at the time were thinking, oh, Christ almighty, what did he do that for?
Uh-huh.
Because the more sensible thing would be just to play the ball into the corner flag, hit it off somebody and get a shy, and that's time up. So... Now, that was interesting for me.
I suppose that's the difference between professional footballers. As fans, at 3-2, it's tight, seconds or a minute to go, there's a part of you thinking, if we could just score now, I can relax.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking like that. These guys are professionals. And they are all just thinking, take this into the corner flag.
Mm-hmm.
Waste time. And they all know the consequences of not doing that, so... I suppose it just gives you an insight into the different way that they look into things. So that was it. Celtic had won the league.
Celtic had won the league, and the players paint a wild scene afterwards. Everybody and anybody was in the dressing rooms, and family, friends, ex-Celtic players. Apparently, the place was full of the Lisbon Lions who were all there to cheer on. A mixture of Billy McNeil and Bobby Lennox, because Billy was the manager and Bobby was still playing. And apparently Wee Jinky and Bobby Murdoch at the end were fairly emotional because Bobby was their pal. And there is a story that there was an all-night lock-in, and that Billy McNeil confirmed that when he came the next morning to open the door up, the main doors at Celtic Park, he said that there was guys still there for the night before. So it seemed a bit wild as well, but... You know, like somebody actually spent the whole night within Celtic Park, but that's true. There was some guys in there, that, some ex-players and some of the backroom staff, I think, were worse for wear and had slept the whole night through and were woken up the next morning, sitting in the dressing rooms, and they still had their beer and champagne.
So what was the best bit about writing the book?
What was
the best bit What was the best thing about writing
the book? For me, was meeting the player, because I'm not a guy who's easily impressed. If I was to meet even the current Celtic team, then I would be happy to meet them, but it wouldn't mean, you know, I wouldn't be that tremendously impressed. But I think there is something when you're younger that you hold footballers in high esteem. And the thing that really pleased me was that all the Celtic players that I spoke to were absolute gems, and they were so encouraging and forthcoming with their time, and they were all very enthusiastic about the project, because they believe in some small way that that's a game that's been lost in the mists of time, because it tends to be trapped between the 9 in a row period and the centenary season.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good Celtic team at the time in the late 70s, early 80s, and a very entertaining team that played a terrific brand of football. And all of them that I spoke to were very helpful in view of the fact that they were happy that I was going to put the story back out there of what went on that season.
So, if that's whetted people's appetite, how do they buy the book?
The book is on Amazon, so it's just like buying any other book on Amazon that you would choose. If you just key in 10 men won the league, and then the book will come up, and I think it's £10.49 on Amazon, and there's no postage, which is a bonus. So if you want to get one for Christmas, or if there's anybody out there what I would say is that if you know anybody who's a Celtic fan that remembers 1979, I think they will enjoy this book. I really mean that, because there's a lot of detail in there, not just about the 4-2 game, but about the whole period of not only of what Celtic were doing at that time, but of what supporting Celtic meant at that time to a great many of us. And it was quite a happy period to look back on, and quite nostalgic as well now looking back on it. But for anybody that's interested, it's available on Amazon.
And it is not just it's not just a pivotal time in Scottish football. It's an amazing time, because it starts off, one of my memories of that time is that season starts when Labour are in power. They're ahead in the opinion polls, and Jim Callaghan decided not to go for a general election. Mm-hmm. And that season finished with Margaret Thatcher winning the first of her general election victories.
Yeah, you're right there, because one of the chapters in the book, I think, is called The Winner of Discontent. And that is how James Callaghan's last few months in power were described historically as the winter of discontent, because there were strikes going on all over the place and strife and
famously the dead not getting buried and littering
the rubbish in the streets and things like that.
One of my own memories from it was being peed off, because lots of schools, their heating was run by, it was Oil Central Heating.
Mm-hmm.
And the oil tanker drivers went on strike.
Mm-hmm.
But because my school was attached, my primary school was attached to a convent, mm-hmm. and so there was people living in the building, they got oil, so all the other schools were shut,
mm-hmm.
and we were still open.
But my recollection of that period is listening to Radio Clyde at 8:30 in the morning, hoping that my school was going to get read as one of the schools that was closed because of the oil shortage, and they used to read the schools out in alphabetical order. And obviously the Saints came near the end,
uh-huh.
and it was like my school at the time, the St Gerard's, so that would have been midway through the Saints. But you were literally praying that you know, like, that the oil tankers never get through. But you're right that there was a lot of that going on. And Thatcher actually came into power a matter of days before the 4-2 game in May 1979.
Quoting St Francis, I think it was.
St. Francis of Assisi.
Yeah, when she came into power.
St. Francis of Assisi, famous quotes.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, the other thing that I'd like to point out as well, that John Doyle is painted as a villain of the piece for the 4-2 game, because he jeopardised Celtic's whole chances of winning the league. But some of the players make the point that if Doyle hadn't got sent off, then they may not have raised their game enough to have won it. And that's a fair point. And also in the book, there is an epilogue at the end where I point out that the following season, the spirit of the 10 men lived on, because the there was two particularly notable games that they were down to 10 men again, and they won through. And John Doyle had his best ever game for Celtic in one of those games. So if Johnny had a wee debt to repay, he repaid it in full that night when Celtic beat St Mirren at Love Street in a Scottish Cup replay.
Well, I'm sure I've got about four books. I have, as you say, one of the benefits of your book is you can delve into bits of it and not have to read the whole book in context. I would suggest, if you're a bit younger and you're not aware, will be good to read it in context, and so read the whole book. If you're older like me, you can dip in and out. It's an excellent book to get anybody for Christmas, as you say, Stephen. A fantastic book to get for someone of our age and older who remembers that time. Perhaps people slightly younger than us who were just starting to become a Celtic supporter at that time might want to read about it. And obviously, if you want to know your history of our club, as you identify, that season and that 4-2 game, one of the most important games in understanding and knowing the history of our club, certainly in the last 40, 50 years. So a fantastic book to read, and the book launch was excellent, and every success. I wish you every success in sales of this book. So get online to Amazon and buy it. So it just leaves me enough to say, Stephen Murray, / St Anthony, thanks for writing the book and thanks for joining me in the podcast.
It's my pleasure again, Harry. Thanks very much for having me on.
Okay, cheers. Hopefully you enjoyed that podcast with St Anthony, and right at the beginning of the podcast I offered you the opportunity to win a signed copy of 10 Men Win the League. So, to make sure you've been paying attention, I just need you to send an email to harrybradycu@gmail.com. That's Harry Brady, all one word, C for Celtic, U for Underground @gmail.com, with the answer to the following question. Name Celtic's top goal scorer that season and how many goals he scored. So if you send that in by Monday the 15th of December, the winner will be picked out and receive a signed copy of the book. If you're not fortunate enough to win the book, or you think there's somebody you know who would appreciate it as a Christmas present, you can go to Amazon.com and order a copy from there. This podcast is bookended by the number ones at the start of the season and the number ones at the end of the season, this one being Blondie and Sunday Girl. Enough from me. That was St Anthony / Stephen Murray. This is me, Harry Brady, saying good night. Good night.